Welcome to the 375th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. Stay tuned for my interview with Chip Jones, author of the book The Organ Thieves, the shocking story of the first heart transplant in the segregated South. Stay tuned for my interview with Chip Jones. The Reading and Writing Podcast is brought to you by Libro FM. Libro.fm lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 185,000 audiobooks, including bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers. You'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there, but you'll be part of a different story. One that supports your local community and your local bookstore. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. You can listen during your commute, while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from people who know audiobooks best, your local bookseller. Here's your special offer from the Reading and Writing Podcast. Get two audiobooks for the price of one today with your first month of membership with the code RWPODCAST at checkout. This offer is only valid for new members in Canada and the U.S., Check out Libro.fm today. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Chip Jones, author of the book, The Organ Thieves, the shocking story of the first heart transplant in the segregated South. Chip has been reporting for nearly 30 years for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Roanoke Times, Virginia Business, and others. As a reporter for the Roanoke Times, he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his work on the Pittston coal strike. Chip, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
Great. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about your book, Organ Thieves, The Shocking Story of the First Heart Transplant in the Segregated South yet, can you describe what happened to Bruce Tucker in May of 1968?
Sure. He was a factory worker. A black man. He was ending his work week with some friends, sitting on a low brick wall behind an Esso station up on Church Hill, which is named for Patrick Henry's St. John's Church. Give me liberty or give me death, a little historical area there. And he was passing the time and had the unfortunate mishap of falling off a wall and hitting his head. Severe head injury, rushed to the by ambulance to the nearest emergency room, at what was then the Medical College of Virginia. He was conscious when he arrived. His vital signs were normal for someone with a head injury, but they were okay. He soon lapsed into a coma, and in less than 24 hours, roughly about 21 hours, really, the surgeons at the hospital were removing life support from him and just made the decision to make him an unwilling or unwitting donor of his heart. And while they were at it, they took both his kidneys. At the same time that the surgeons who had been looking for a donor, such as Mr. Tucker, for some time, at that same time, Tragically, Mr. Tucker's brother, William, was trying to find him, frantically trying to find him, from his nearby shoe repair shop, Tucker's Shoe Repair, which had been there many years, not far from the hospital. And he was making calls, and so was a friend, a lady friend of Mr. Tucker's, was frantically trying to find him, and they got no confirmation of where he was or no information. It wasn't until nearly 2 days later when William Tucker was talking to the funeral director that he asked them the very shocking and sobering question, William, did you know that Bruce's heart is missing and so are his kidneys? And that's how the book begins.
Wow. And so can you explain who received his heart?
The recipient was a gentleman named Joseph Klett. He was a businessman from Orange, Virginia, north of Richmond. He was severely ill with heart disease. He had no idea where the heart was coming from, nor did Mr. Klett's wife. It was just they were there to be treated. And he was seen as someone who would be a good candidate for a heart transplant because you had to be severely near death to be considered for such an experimental procedure.
And how did the story about Bruce Tucker and his death and the subsequent harvesting of his heart and kidneys, how did that story originally reach the press about Tucker and what happened to him?
Well, it came out very slowly. It took several days before Mr. Tucker's name actually was leaked, which was kind of an interesting process for me as a former reporter to see how the institution of the hospital had kept that under wraps. And the only reason the name came out was when a night desk person at the Richmond Times-Dispatch took an obituary from this small funeral home down in rural Virginia, Stony Creek, Virginia, near Petersburg, takes the obit, and the funeral director, the same person who had just notified William Tucker about this shocking event, said to the person taking the obit, this is the guy they're talking about in this, all the stories about the historic heart transplant, because the headlines were Virginian surgeons do first heart transplant. So the funeral director not only was, you know, breaking the bad news, but he was kind of proud in some ways that his client was part of this historic event. Well, at that point, the obit writer took that information over to the medical reporter who put it together that night and had it in the paper the next day. That was Tuesday after the Saturday transplant.
And so how did you learn about Bruce Tucker's case and how did you decide to write a book about this?
I worked for sort of a second career as a communications director at the local medical society, Richmond Academy of Medicine, which has a vast reserve of oral histories and lots of historical things. And I actually began thinking about this as a possible book idea because I had written three books on military history, and I was waiting for another good nonfiction book idea to come along. And when I heard about this historic transplant, what I gravitated toward was the name, a familiar name from the past, which was Dr. Christian Barnard. And Barnard, as you probably know, and a lot of your listeners know, but some of the younger ones may not know, was once a medical superstar who I always sort of say was like Dr. Anthony Fauci meets Bill Gates. I mean, he was on every cover of the old magazines and newspapers. And so basically, I was fascinated by the fact that Christian Barnard had studied under those same heart transplant surgeons who had taken the heart from Mr. Tucker. He had studied less than a year before he, Barnard, won the heart transplant race. And essentially, he had taken their techniques, especially using extreme cold to preserve organs. He had taken those back to Cape Town and was a very little known surgeon at the time. He took the chance and did the first heart transplant. Afterwards, at Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, there was a lot of hurt feelings in a sense that they'd kind of been robbed of the opportunity to win this race, which they had hoped at some point to do, but they had not. And by the time 6 months later, when Mr. Tucker was rolled into the emergency room, I've always said it was like he was in the crosshairs of history. He arrived at the wrong place and the wrong time for a black man, working man, to have a little bit of liquor on his breath. No one looking for him, apparently, which was not true, as the book shows, and basically with no clout. And he was viewed as, you know, as I say in the book, a doctor on the scene at that time told me he was viewed as, quote unquote, a charity patient who would never pay his bills. And that's when I learned about what happened to Bruce Tucker. My imagination was fired early on by the idea of a book about kind of a parallel book to the space race, the heart race, you know, The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe, who was from Richmond, incidentally. Always, you know, loved his books. And I thought there could be a book there about the heart transplant race and how it kind of wove through Richmond. But once I learned about what had transpired with Bruce Tucker and then his family and trying to get some type of justice, which they never got, it turned from sort of a work of my imagination about history. It was much more driven by the moral and ethical failures that happened, and much more a book about social justice.
Well, I think you alluded to it in your last answer, but I'm curious, do you have a sense of the mindset of the doctors in the hospital in 1968? Did they think that they just had control over his body? And were there any kind of ethical discussions?
The only discussions that happened on the fly in basically it was about 21 hour period, but really over a period about 10 hours with a very low level medical examiner who was on duty. He was an assistant medical examiner, and the doctors had so much more power than he had that they essentially got the outcome that they won, especially one doctor in particular, Dr. David Hume, who was the head of the surgery department. You know, he was a type AAA surgeon. He was a very smart man. And those to answer your question about, you know, where was the regulation or the ethical framework in Richmond at that point, and in other hospitals around the country, there was not the framework we have today of organ transplantation, of the laws that were passed in the 80s. There was not that. The lawyers themselves who represented these doctors called them the gods in white coats. They had really almost complete power and authority inside their departments and inside the hospital. The administrators were very much on the sideline. And even though the law in Virginia at that point required a 24-hour waiting period, the medical examiner decided to allow them to just ignore it, because if they waited 24 hours, his heart wouldn't have been viable. Just another historical fact at that point was there was a lot of changing thinking about the nature of what constituted death. And that's also a theme of in my book. This is a topic that, as I read more medical ethics about transplantation ethics, it still is not completely settled, at least ethics, out in the real world. And at that point, the prevailing thought among more progressive doctors, and these guys were not from the South, they were from Boston or they were from Chicago. It was their mindset that, you know, the guys in Harvard, the Harvard Ad Hoc Commission on Brain Death, which was issued a report after the Tucker transplantation. The thinking was that we need to follow the law, but there's going to be times when we're basically kind of going to bend the rules, because the law has not caught up with science. And that's exactly what happened in this case. It took about 5 years before Virginia passed its first law that allowed brain death in the definition of death in the state code. And Virginia was the second state in the country to pass that. So, you know, it was not settled law, and it was left in the hands of the doctors.
Well, I know that there was a legal case brought against the Medical College of Virginia over Bruce Tucker's transplant, or harvesting, I should say. Can you tell us about that case and the lawyer who sued?
Sure. Well, Doug Wilder was the lawyer, and he was that was another reason, Jeff, that I got interested in this as a book, because Doug Weld is a huge historical figure, certainly in Virginia. And for the United States, he was the first elected African-American to become governor of any state. At that point in 1968, he got a phone call from a very distraught William Tucker, who'd read about Mr. Wilder in the papers, and asked him to represent the family. And right away, Doug Wilder began asking tough questions. And within a couple of years, he took about 2 years to finally file this civil complaint. It was the first wrongful death lawsuit in the country that had to do with heart transplants. It took 2 years to come to trial, and as the readers will see, it was a case. It was a David and Goliath case. Wilder being the David, he was a one man operation. He was a criminal attorney. He was making a living doing cases all day. He had a difficult road to hoe to fight the full faith and credit and legal power of the state of Virginia. And as he told me, he gave me the first interview. He told me in 45 years, he never wanted to talk about it. He said that, you know, he knew going in that this was going to be a tough case, because the state of Virginia was not going to kind of back down from this wonderful historic accomplishment. And that's how it unfolded, and how the state managed to line up all these same brilliant neurosurgeons from Harvard and other universities and ethicists that came in, and they said, you know, basically.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
He wasn't going to live. They did a good thing with his heart. And that was, and they convinced the jury. The judge allowed it in, even though brain death was not in the state code. So it was, again, one of these things where, in Mr. Wilder's view, you know, it was all about, you know, the racial or the power dynamic, I should say, really. But it also had the racial undertones, of course, because the man had no power. And there was a feeling, certainly by Mr. Wilder, when I interviewed him, that there was at that point in time, 1972, the racial situation in Richmond was still very unsettled. That's why we have segregated South in the subtitle, because the South was very slow to truly desegregate, and the schools were not desegregated at that point. So it was a very, very touchy case.
Well, and I should point out that for those listeners who aren't political junkies, that Doug Wilder, the lawyer that we're mentioning, later became the governor of Virginia, just as an FYI. I'm curious, was there ever any type of acknowledgement or apology by any of the physicians or surgeons, especially as it relates to the racial angle?
No, there really wasn't. I looked for that, and I know that there was recently. This story really hasn't stopped unfolding, Jeff, because for the first time in 50 years, the now VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine, and the Medical College of Virginia Foundation, they actually put a kind of a sort of apology on an old article about Dr. Lauer from several years ago. I just learned about that when a reporter was interviewing me last week. And I said, you know, that's the first time they've sort of said his name. And to answer your question, the surgeons themselves, they really felt like they were doing their job to try to save Mr. Klett's life, and their attitude was that they weren't the ones in charge of Mr. Tucker, and that's how it came across in the trial. You know, they weren't his treating physician, and this is I did not ever hear regret from either one of them, and sadly one of them, as your readers will see, or the readers of the book will see, one of them didn't live that much longer after the trial, so. But to answer your question, no, there was never any formal apology or even informal apology that I know of, because I've been in touch with the Tucker family.
Well, in the segregated South, there are certainly incidents of African Americans being used for medical research, often against their will, I should add. Did you study any of those other incidents when you were researching your book?
Yes. I quickly pivoted to trying to tell the story of how, not only in the South, but in the North as well, the entire U.S. medical system was built on the backs of Black Americans, and that goes back to Harvard in the late 1700s and into the 1800s, all through the 19th century. The way that dissection was taught, and that was the only hands-on class in medical schools. Everything else was book learning. So the hands-on classes, the anatomy classes, were supplied with bodies by grave robbers body snatchers, as they're called, or resurrectionists, which is another strange term. And this happened up and down the East Coast, including Richmond. And it went on longer, I think, in the South, up to the dawn of the 20th century. And these guys would work with most medical colleges had somebody called a body man, and often was, at least in the South, African American. And he would look at funerals during the day and spock them out, and then meet criminal groups or gangs of people who would dig them up and take them back into this very strange building, the Egyptian building that's still here in Richmond, take them in and take them to the basement and prepare them for classes the next day. This man at the Medical College of Virginia has a very colorful career. There's been a documentary made about him. It's called Chris Baker. He actually lived there for decades and decades, up to close to 1920. And again, this is what kind of blew my mind in my research, Jeff, you know, because my father was born before then. So it was like, I'm reading this, I'm thinking, this is stuff that you think of as, you know, part of, well, it's in Dickens, you know, A Tale of Two Cities. Sure. You know, so it bled over, and it was stopped at some point. But the lack of dignity and treatment of bodies in a way you would think would be ethical or dignified, that didn't start until way later, maybe in the forties maybe. But there's a lot of old pictures, medical. Students were kind of like frat boys, and they would play games and do really awful things with the bodies. And there's pictures of them that I said they're really creepy. And that's part of the story I really try not to hammer on too much in the book, because there's enough weird kind of macabre things in the Organ Thieves for any one reader. But it has to be understood that this was the context of medical education, that these practices bled over into the 20th century. And then there's a lot in my book about, you know, the very explosive, incendiary racial situation, political situation in Richmond at that time too. And that also contributed to the police never finding William Tucker, even though the hospital said they were trying to find him. It was just all messed up. And one side didn't know what the other was doing. The surgeon didn't know that William Tucker was calling the front desk. And later on, the most shocking thing was when he found his own business card in his dead brother's pockets, and his card had been there all along if someone had just called him and let him know. And at the very least, the family could have visited him and made some decisions about what was going to become of him.
Sure. Well, the transplant and the harvesting that you write about was in 1968, and here we are in 2020 with a global pandemic.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that there's still a disparity of healthcare for African Americans. Do you address that in the book, or I mean, obviously the book was written before the pandemic. Yeah. What are your thoughts about that?
Sure.
In terms of that ongoing disparity.
Yeah, I think what's in the book that applies to now, of course, it's not in the issue of disparity is in the book, and the issue of what's known as historical trauma is in the epilogue of the book, because the Tucker case has now become more of part of the education at the School of Medicine. Whether it's because of my work or not, I honestly don't know, but it is part of the historical thread here of things. It's like how not to do something. But to get to your point about now is I've heard from a number of African-American scholars and others in the medical community that the suspicions in the in communities of color, Black, Brown, many different minority groups, those suspicions linger for a lot longer than I think than I knew, you know, as a white male person raised in privilege. I never knew I was being interviewed by a not old African American scholar recently. He said he grew up in New York, and he said, "Oh yeah, we were told never to go into a hospital because they're just going to cut you." Now, why those suspicions are still there, that's a whole other realm of research. And my book is not an academic book, by the way. It's a popular history. You know, it's a nonfiction narrative, and it's meant to present things to people that, you know, some of the academics might say, "Well, we knew about that." Well, you know, I think the role for me as a writer, as an investigative reporter, has always been you bring out things that may have been sitting there under people's noses for a long time, and here is for a half a century. And I started piecing it together because I knew that most people don't know about, for example, the historical trauma that a lot of African Americans have felt over the decades or even centuries, and how that goes down to when I talked to Doug Wilder. He talked about he grew up in Richmond. He was told, don't go down near that hospital. The night doctors are going to snatch you. That was part of his narrative of his life. And that was in the 30s and 40s. And I was kind of heartened that a local scholar who teaches classes at Virginia Commonwealth had done his own research. And he had talked to some young people, you know, in their 20s, who still had those suspicions, who still held those. So in terms of COVID and treatment and getting people to trust in medicine, these are issues that have to be addressed. I think they can be addressed, but I think this has to be done in a really sensitive and thoughtful way.
Sure. Well, a few months after Bruce Tucker's death, the Medical College of Virginia transplanted a heart into an African-American recipient. Can you tell us about that case?
Yeah, Lewis Russell. I love the case of Lewis Russell because, you know, after all the mistakes made with Bruce Tucker, I wanted to include, for the purposes of objectivity, that MCV did have a successful second heart transplant. And in that case, they did talk to a young man's family. And after the young man had been shot, and he was African-American, happened to be, and they agreed to have his heart transplanted to this gentleman. Lewis Russell was a teacher. He was a shop teacher from Indianapolis, Indiana, and he became just a wonderful spokesman for the American Heart Association. He lived, I think, about at least 7 years, and he was just a bright shining light. And his recovery went well, and he went back and taught school, and then he became a chaplain for the Indianapolis Police Department. His wife was a wonderful woman, Thelma, and she was the first Black person to be a department store buyer in the Midwest. So they were just a great family. And in the context of my book, I also mentioned, you know, they were just public relations gold for MCV after having this terrible first transplant. And it was interesting to me, Jeff, as a reporter, to see how, you know, they revealed nothing about Tucker initially, and much less later, really. But they made the Russells really open to reporters and to the media, and it was just classic spin control.
Sure. Well, are you working on another book now?
I am working on the novel that I stopped writing to write this 3 years ago. I've been working on a book about growing up in the high desert of California in the mid-60s. And it's basically about love and grief in 1965 when I was a kid. And I call it Summer of Satisfaction because that's the summer that the Stones released Satisfaction.
That's great. Well, mm-hmm. What novels or nonfiction books have you enjoyed reading recently?
Novels?
Nonfiction.
No, I love to read. I really like to read a mix of nonfiction. I'm reading Douglas Brinkley's biography of Walter Cronkite, which I find fascinating because he started out in Kansas City. And Brinkley gave me a nice blurb on my book, so I figured I better buy something by Douglas Brinkley. Tremendous book. I love, as a former English graduate student who started out in the Hollins Writings Program, I love returning to old authors like Hermann Hesse. There's a tremendous German biographer, Decker, who wrote Hesse, his The Wanderer and His Shadow. And it's so interesting how all of the pressures that Hesse had as a novelist in the 20s and 30s in Germany to go from being a writer to an activist, 100 years later, pre-Nazi Germany has a lot of strange parallels to the things we've been going through here in America in the past few years. I've been fascinated by that. So I love kind of going back and forth. Elmore Leonard. If I'm at the beach, Elmore Leonard. Trevor Noah's Born a Crime, what a great memoir, and that actually I was reading that while I was writing this book because everything about South Africa and there's apartheid and the shameful attitudes, toward people. I read Elton John's memoir, Me. I was amazed at what a good book that was. I'm a music fan, like a lot of people. Springsteen's Born to Run. So,
Springsteen's Born to Run is amazing.
Oh my God. And didn't you have the sense that he actually wrote it himself? I mean,
he did. He did. I mean, everything that I've read, he wrote every word himself.
Yeah. Everything that's so ghostwritten. And I had a feeling, Elton John at least wrote most of it, but, I don't know. I go back. I love to, go back and forth in history. I read Halberstam's The 50s, David Halberstam's The 50s, when I was researching what happened to Eisenhower and his heart for my book. There's one writer who really helped me start to do narrative nonfiction who you don't hear much about anymore. Do you know the work of John Toland at all?
I've heard the name. I haven't read much.
Well, I got to know John several decades ago because he won several Pulitzer Prizes, but he was one of the earliest practitioners of narrative nonfiction. And his book, The Rising Sun, about the Pacific War, mm-hmm. won the Pulitzer for history. Check it out. And he wrote the first book about Hitler, which is just called Hitler. It's a huge tome. He actually went back and lived where Hitler lived and slept in the same garrets. And I was fortunate to know him because he actually wrote a novel later in his life where he used my father as his protagonist. That's called Gods of War. So I got to know him pretty well. And the thing about John was, I was thinking about this before I came on, he had an ideogram above his desk that meant in Japanese, eliminate self. And that's pretty much what I tried to do in this book. You'll see me at the end visiting the son of Bruce Tucker. And I kind of shifted the narrative. But John was always about letting the characters come alive in his work. And it struck me thinking about how self-absorbed a lot of writers are now. It's like the opposite of now. For what it's worth, those are my influences.
Yeah. Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your book?
Oh, chipjonesbooks.com.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Chip Jones, author of the book, The Organ Thieves, The Shocking Story of the First Heart Transplant in the Segregated South. The book is available now, so go buy a copy. And Chip, thanks for doing this interview.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
Great.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from JELD-WEN. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on JELD-WEN windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save.